Well, we all know Glenn Kimball and his work for so many years here on Coast to Coast AM. So when we get into an opportunity for you to call to Glenn, it can be on a variety of topics, but we pushed away a little bit from 2012 there just at the tail end of last hour. We can go back to that with you. You can ask about other ancient manuscripts, and we can continue to pick at what Glenn Kimball's research indicates the year 2012 is going to be like for the world, if not exactly on that date, within a reasonable amount of time from the beginning of that date. We'll start to see perhaps our last days as we know them before the planet regenerates, before we would be entering into a new age, an age when, much like the beginning of the Bible, where we would almost have to recreate ourselves. And you'll get into this conversation whichever way you want to go with Glenn Kimball next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Hey, by the way, Glenn, are you making any more strides toward having a brick-and-mortar structure for Kimball College?
Probably not.
Really?
I hate to be confined to that. I probably will have to, but I wouldn't. You know, people to travel and actually take the course, they can take them online.
Yeah, I like that idea, but I also like the idea of, you never know where that would go. If you started a college that people actually could attend, and make a 4-year or 2-year university program out of it, where people could go and actually study these manuscripts and work, you know, directly one-on-one with professors and actually get a real focus, what that might grow into. I mean, it's such a novel idea for an institution.
We've been asked to do that. And by the way, I need to make a correction from last hour. It's not Genghis Khan. It was Kublai Khan.
Oh, okay.
It was connected with John Prester. But you're right. We've been asked a couple of times to take accreditation affiliation with various educational institutions, but my experience with colleges leads me to believe that the heads of departments and schools tend to dictate your content. And so far, I've felt relaxed and able to do exactly what the texts tell me to do, you know, without having to bow to the powers that be that, hey, you can't talk about those kind of subjects or we're not going to accredit your class, you know.
Well, if you ever do decide to build a Kimball College somewhere, the Ivy, you know, covered walls of Kimball College, I'd like, if you would, offer me a professorship teaching hygiene. Okay, that'd be probably all I can be qualified for. But
I have greater plans than that for you, Ian.
Okay, all right. Well, that's all I'm asking is I'll be the professor of hygiene. Let's go east of the Rockies. Jerry is in Tulsa on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. Jerry?
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Great. Hey, by the way, this is the absolute most fascinating show I've heard in a long time. I've been listening to the show for years, and I've never been as enthralled in a show like I have tonight. Great job, guys.
Thank you. Glad you're enjoying it. Go ahead.
With all due respect, Glenn, I've loved what you've been saying, so don't take this the wrong way, but you've made the comment twice now that it's ignorant, and not ignorant, I'm sorry, that it was naive and childish to believe that their presence of a sun god was in response to their scientific ignorance, right?
Well, let me clarify it. When people say that they created or artificially created God and used as the representative of that God, the sun, as that God, to compensate for all the things they did not know, that scenario is hogwash.
Okay. Well, what they didn't know, for instance, is that the sun was a burning ball of helium gas. They didn't know, like, for instance,
don't be too sure.
I'm sorry?
Don't be too sure.
Did they know then?
They most certainly did.
Okay. With all other polytheistic societies the world over, for instance, Neptune, the god of the water, they had no idea that the moon influenced the tide. They assumed that there was a god that influenced the tide.
Someone has told you that in your college classes. And they knew it perfectly well that the moon influenced the tides. We've accredited them with ignorance when they were smarter than we thought they were.
Here's an interesting thought, and Jerry, I'd be curious how you feel about this. It does seem like there is a dichotomy to this, Glenn, that there are both these named gods and these, you know, icons that get developed, but also incredible, you know, even if we focused on, to say, Greco-Roman knowledge, here they had, you know, somebody like Neptune or Poseidon, but at the same time, they also were doing work, you know, fairly sophisticated astronomical work. So is it possible to say, and Jerry, I don't know where you are with this, that really there was like, it was like two things at once. There was one that was sort of the clever, fun, symbolic way of understanding it and trying to understand it in a way which explained sort of the divine aspect of the universe, and another way which was the scientific way. Not unlike perhaps how we still do it in our culture, where, you know, we have a talking sun in, you know, like, say, a breakfast sandwich commercial for a fast food joint, and we've got the sun talking to the moon, and we kind of do that sort of thing in animation, but at the same time, that just because we see that or we think of it that way, it doesn't mean we no longer think of it as a big ball of gas.
Well, looking at the concept of, like, for instance, I forget what society believed this, but the sun was being charged across the sky upon a chariot, that there was something that physically carried the sun across the sky.
Well, that's what you learned in college. That's not what they taught.
Is that not what anybody believed whatsoever?
Well, certainly there were people that believed that. There's also people who believe that there's no God in our day, which is a mythology. It's a mythology that we've created for ourselves. That there's no deity, there's no intentional design in the universe. That's as much of a fantasy as Disneyland cartoons.
Well, I'm one who believes that the concept of the God, especially the Christian God, the one who died on the cross, as being no more a fantasy than believing in a polytheistic society. I think our imagination has come up with these answers, which is there must be a presence of a God because we don't know what happens after we die. And I think that is paralleled in societies the world over. Like I said, that must be why there's aren't too many polytheistic societies around, because our scientific knowledge has grown so much.
Well, you talk to Graham Hancock and others, and they will tell you that in our world, with all of our advanced understanding, that we really are a society of amnesia. We've forgotten all the things that we used to know. You know, Hall wrote a book called The Beyond Culture in the 70s, and it was one of my favorites. And he made the comment in his book, he said that we ought to require high school students to live in the third world for a year before they graduate from high school as a requirement. And I happen to believe in that, because for some reason, if you've been confined in the United States, you're raised on the mythology that America is the greatest society in the world because of our money, that we are the beautiful people, and we're the ones that know everything. And when you live abroad, like I have for so many years, one of the things that happened to me when I returned to the LAX or the LA airport after having lived in Bolivia for such a long time, I sat down and I couldn't help but sob. Not because I hated my own people, but because I realized how ignorant they were. That we really think we know everything. We really think that our universities are teaching some advanced college, some advanced knowledge, when our ancestors knew more than we did, than we do today.
And well, let's leave it there for the time being, because we have so many other callers. But I enjoyed actually the dialogue you had going with Jerry, and maybe Jerry will shoot an email.
Jerry's a good guy.
Yeah, and I wonder too whether polytheism in our culture is different than we look for it, and that our polytheism might include, you know, the worship of money and material things, and,
well, behind,
you know,
any good mythology,
widescreen TVs, and
the stories that we tell about the beliefs of our ancestors gets mushed in the translation. You know, I'm you ought to take my class on astrology. You'd find out that behind the good astrology tales is a real scientific history, not the one we tell ourselves about astrology, but the one that actually existed.
West of the Rockies, TJ is in Tucson on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. TJ?
Yes, sir. I was wondering if there were any Planet X scenarios associated with 2012.
Oh, that's
or in
a
the
great
past.
Question. Wish I'd thought of that. Really good question. Planet X.
Well, the Colburn talks about a Planet X.
I'd be a lot more afraid of the alignment problem than a Planet X. I haven't found any scientific journals or any scientific information. Part of me is terribly scientific. I haven't found any evidence of a Planet X. We talk about Orpheus, and it perhaps collided with the Earth and caused some of the debris field, and also altered when it created our moon for us, and those kinds of things. But I don't see a collisionary course between some Planet X and the Earth, though it is mentioned in the Colburn. How do I know? That's the only source I know of it.
In the Colburn Bible. But nothing in the Mayan calendar or anything that gets talked about in the Mayan tradition. First-time caller line, Greg is in L.A. for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Greg?
Hello, Ian. Hello, Glenn.
Hello.
I feel very privileged to have gotten through this evening. Glenn, you just recently spoke of this John that was the best friend of Christ.
Prester John was the character that is sometimes spoken of as being a king that lived outside of the Holy Land that was still reigning over the Garden of Eden, and perhaps was John the Apostle.
I see. And you mentioned that among his journeys, he ended up in China?
Well, he began there.
He began there.
Well, he crossed over the Himalayas, left his teachings with the Assyrian monks in Tibet, left them all away in little teeny towns all the way across the Silk Trade routes, and had an enormous impact in China for 1,300 years, was still alive by the time of Marco Polo. Marco Polo met him.
Well, now, at the time that John was taking his journey, that was before Christianity had begun. Is that correct?
No.
No.
My understanding was that Christianity didn't really begin until several hundred years after the death of Christ.
No.
Well, that's a story that we learn in our schools.
Right.
If you can alter that thinking just a little bit and realize that all the religions of the earth come from a common source, if you want to talk about Jesus, Jesus is the only character that transcends all five major religious categories. He is the great Buddha Isa for the Buddhists and the Confucianists. He is the greatest prophet in Hinduism and also in the Judaic world. He's still the greatest prophet there. And he is also the one who was the greatest prophet for Muhammad. Muhammad did not...
Muhammad
never envisioned himself as being the leader of a movement. He envisioned himself as restoring the confusion back into clarity from the Judeo-Christian concepts.
Yes, I have always believed that all of the great masters were one, as you just described. That's something that I've always intuitively believed, and I'm saying that as a Jew. My question is this. Did the travels of John create any Judaism across any of those countries?
I'm sorry, any schism?
Any Judaism.
He's
making the point, and I think it's an interesting one to consider, whether in John's travels did he leave behind as well a Judaic understanding of the world as well as the new developing Christological one.
Well, that's really a brilliant comment. I think he did. I think he really did, especially with the concepts of the temple protocol. We find the evidences of that in China to this day, which I directly attribute to John, and which were, you know, the Jews claimed to basically own the concept of a temple, because they rebuilt the temple after Cyrus gave them back their freedom from the time of the Babylonian conquest. They refused to, Zerubbabel refused to let anybody else help them rebuild the temple. In our day, in Israel today, they have all the construction materials set out to rebuild this temple on the Holy Mount. They actually have a place to put it, because the Dome of the Rock does not sit on the exact site where the Temple of Herod or the Temple of Solomon was actually stood. But the reason why they don't do it is because they don't know what the temple was used for. I've had the people from the Knesset come to the Americas asking the question, does anyone have an idea what really went on inside these things? And it wasn't just burning incense and sacrificing a lamb here or there. We know from the biblical account that in order to go through this entire educational process of the temple, it took about 6 hours. And that's certainly much more than lighting a little bit of incense and sacrificing a dove and sitting down and saying your prayers. there was a lot more going on inside these buildings in an educational fashion than is currently known by the general Judaic population.
And thank you for the question, Greg. I wonder, though, Glenn, I think it'd be more fair to say that the Israel isn't going to mess around with building anything near the Dome of the Rock for what that might mean in terms of, you know, political, military, you know, terroristic, you know, instability.
It would certainly be a big target, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Let's go wildcard line. Rich is in New Orleans on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. Oh, Rick. I'm sorry, Rick.
Yeah. Thank you, Professor Kimball and Ian. Good evening from New Orleans. I have kind of a two-part question. I was curious about the Mormons, and you mentioned people leaving west of leaving Eden and maybe the lost tribes of Israel, et cetera. Why do the Mormons think that Eden is in, like, Missouri? And my second part of my question is about Atlantis. Does that predate or postdate Eden itself, and perhaps that is tied in with the Mormons somehow? I find that confusing to me, and I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Good question.
Well, I can't speak for Mormonism. I try not to speak for them or for anybody, for that matter. Mormons believe that the Adam on Diamond in Missouri was the place of the Garden of Eden. Coincidentally, the Arkansas National Forest is very close. And by the way, my cave site there on the Amber River off the Ohio River, where we're exploring those caverns that still have artifacts in them, is very close as well. So, you know, I can't speak for that to that issue. I can't explain someone's doctrine that let them explain their own. What was the second part of the question?
My second part of the question was regarding Atlantis. I would assume Atlantis was post Eden and not something before the Garden of Eden.
No, it was definitely pre Eden. Atlantis was an epic of approximately 11,600 years ago. In fact, that was the there have been four epochs of time when there have been human beings on the earth, and a lot of people think that Plato was the only one that ever spoke about Atlantis. Well, that's completely crazy, because Hesiod spoke about it, and Hesiod predated Plato. As a matter of fact, Plato learned from the book that Hesiod left, the Theologica, about the previous epochs of time. We all credit Plato with being the one trying to target the actual city of Atlantis. I don't know why in the world someone doesn't pick up the Hesiod documents and try and learn it from there. I mean, it's in the same public library.
All right. Coming up to the end of this segment, and we'll get more. And I guess real quickly, five-second answer for Bill, for Rick in New Orleans is he should be very mindful of 2012 if the water situation changes. More with Glenn Kimball next on Coast to Coast AM. Heading into our last half hour with Glenn Kimball from Kimball College. We'll line them all up. We'll get to as many of your questions. Think of it this way. Think of it as right after the lecture from Professor Kimball, and you've got a few minutes with the professor after class, but you got a long line of kids behind you. So let's make sure we get to the questions as quickly as possible so we can get everybody on the air. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Glenn Kimball can be found through coasttocoastam.com. Let's pick it up with Bill, who's in Michigan on Coast to Coast AM. Bill?
Hi, Ian and Glenn. I live in Sault Ste. Marie. About 70 miles west of me is Newberry. And from what I understand, from reading on the Internet, that back in 1848 they found some Minoan tablets there from approximately 2500 BC. That
Glenn, are you familiar with that?
Absolutely. You'd love to take my class called the Michigan Tablets. You'd freak. And especially the class on Gnosis, that's called Gnosis. The mining, the copper mining that was taking place in 1800 years BC in Michigan.
Yep.
And where they, those copper ingots were taken. By the way, I'll give you a hint. The picture of the people carrying off the copper ingots off the Phoenician ships are on the walls in Egypt, in Luxor.
So they were coming to mine for copper in Michigan from Egypt.
Absolutely. Egypt, you know how much copper was necessary just to build the pyramids? And all of the stone sculptures, the stone carvings all up and down the Nile River all the way to Abu Simbel. The little bit of copper mining that was being conducted in Egypt and all of the copper mines that were going on in Spain could not have supplied one-tenth of the copper necessary to keep the Bronze Age alive and well and doing the things they were doing in Egypt. As a matter of fact, Hatshepsut herself sent an armada after she figured out where the Phoenicians were getting the copper. She sent 10 boats to the source and brought back copper for herself into Egypt, and she sent them to the Americas into Michigan.
Very interesting. Wildcard line, Francis is in California on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. Francis?
Oh, good evening, gentlemen. What a pleasure to speak with you. Professor Kimball, what a shock tonight. I was told back in approximately 1961, 62, that the books that were destroyed in Alexandria would resurface, their counterpart would resurface in Central America, in the Mexican Peninsula there, Yucatan. And you've already mentioned it tonight. Did the book say anything, or did your people say anything about levitation discs or the twins holding the double-headed snake?
Yeah, there's a lot of that levitation-type materials. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that Don Juan Matis taught Carlos Castaneda's were the teachings of the ancients with regard to levitation. Not only levitation, but travel to the center of the universe, where matter was created and destroyed. Absolute, ma'am. I don't know where you got your information from, but they told you the truth.
It wasn't from this planet.
Well, you got a pipeline I don't have.
Well, that's true. But it was levitation discs that were tuned to a person's own vibrations, that they could lift anything and move it wherever they wanted it.
Well, that. There's a lot of research to support that. I could go back to Egypt, for example. When I was there, Zahi Hawass took me to the engineer who actually architected the building engineered the building of the Khufu pyramid, and he took me to his tomb. And lo and behold, this guy was only about 3 foot tall. These 3 foot people, these very short, I call them the short people. Were the ones who were the greatest engineers, and they used vibrations to move great stones. Pardon me, but that tradition is in the Mayan writings as well, that they had these very short people who would whistle and move stones with their whistles, you know. And there's a lot of text that talk about having Buddhist monks witness the moving of blocks with sonic vibrations.
Karen is in Wichita on the wildcard line for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Karen?
Hi, Ian. Your little screener told me to be brief, so I just want to make a couple of comments, and then I'll just hang up and let you talk. I think there are many, many references in Scripture to traveling through tubes and traveling through gates, and I think these are actually wormholes, what we call wormholes now. And I think that's what's going to be reestablished in 2012. And I think that the agenda is being pushed harder because we are being so interfered with, and we are being kept ignorant, and even more so now. Now,
okay.
The reason that the scriptures are owned by, who did he say owned it? The Rockefellers on most of the scriptures, so
no,
your magazine owns the others.
What? Who owns the...
No, she's referring to the National Geographic.
The National Geographic that owns some of those scriptures. The reason they own what they do is because the Rockefellers own the others. And you can't even imagine what is in the basement of the Smithsonian and probably a lot of the things that came out of the museum in Babylon, Baghdad.
Well, it's an interesting thought. I've never heard anybody claim that the Rockefellers own the Bible or the scriptures. Glenn, what's your thought on that?
Well, I knew some of the Rockefeller family. They were wonderful people. I didn't find them to be intrusive at all. But she's right about one thing, that there were great libraries. Probably the greatest library in our day dealing with these subject materials is the Royal British Library. It's bigger than the Vatican. You know, the Vatican's been kind of cut down the middle at the time of Mussolini. They realized that the Vatican Library was going to be, had a very strong chance of being violated, so they moved a lot of the text to Montreal, Canada, where they still remain to this day. And I've lectured on the circuit with the curator of that library, and there's a lot of them still there. But the largest library in the world dealing with this subject is in Britain. And by the way, the largest library in history was the Ionian Library, not the Alexandria Library. We always point to the burning of the Alexandria Library by Ptolemy X, the little brat brother of Cleopatra, as being the greatest disaster of all time. Well, that's not true, because the Ionian Library still contained all the original texts. And they're still with us today, you know.
The original texts are?
The text from... that went into the Alexandria Library. Remember, Ptolemy was Greek. I mean, Cleopatra, up until Cleopatra, none of the Ptolemy pharaonic line even spoke Egyptian. They all spoke pure Greek. So, you know, the greatest libraries in the world were taught in Greek. When Paul and people like Paul and who else was went to school in Alexandria, I forget. But anyway, when they went to Alexandria, they learned the scriptures in Greek, not in Egyptian and not in Aramaic.
Let me ask you, though, back to the question about the Rockefellers owning the scriptures. Could she be referring to or having heard this in conjunction with who owns the oldest form of the Bible texts that we know?
It could easily be. The Rockefeller Foundation has been a philanthropic organization which has helped preserve ancient texts for a lot of years, and a lot of people presume that that means that they own and control and hide it. I would be a lot more afraid of the National Geographic Society than I would be of the Rockefeller Foundation. But it's not because I'm against the National Geographic. I think they're wonderful people. The birds and the bees, heck almighty, have made the dentist visits for me just wonderful. I wish I had a subscription in my home, you know. But nevertheless, their agenda was when John Wesley Powell sent his emissaries out, they took these burial mounds in the Mississippi Valley and deliberately destroyed them, and the tens of thousands of artifacts that were just simply given to John Wesley Powell, he destroyed them.
All right. Leota is west of the Rockies in Oregon on Coast to Coast AM. Go ahead, Leota.
You are totally refreshing. I'm just so honored to speak with you. Zondervan Press actually is who you want to kind of investigate on who made the Living Bible and the NIV. A lot of us who study in the Hebrew call it the New Illuminati version. But Zondervan Press is who has created a lot of the Bibles, and besides the King James and the Peshitta and the Aramaic and those that are encrypted. You know, and I would love to send you some codes, by the way. I do some codes, but my comment was, in researching scripture, in the last chapter of the Old Testament, in Malachi 4, verse 2, it refers to, it says, "But unto you that fear my name shall the Son, S-U-N, of righteousness arise with healing of his wings, and he shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall." The Hebrew number for that is 8121, and it is referring to the brilliant, the sun, the window, the place of the sun coming through. And it's my contention, and I've done a lot of study, and I have some codes I would love to send you, that this is the seventh trap. And within those 7-day period of the Milky Way having a correct alignment to the Earth from the sun, I believe when Yeshua said that we will not know the hour or day, I believe we will know the month and the year. And I just wanted to ask you what you thought about that, because in studying all the references, it appears that the same anomalies that are going to happen at the seventh trump will happen on December 22nd, 2012.
Glenn?
Well, you know, I like Malachi for the last verse in the Old Testament when he said, "Before the great and dreadful day of the Lord, I'll send Elijah the prophet, and he shall turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the children to the fathers, lest I smite the earth with a curse." The curse he was talking about was the curse of the Mayan prophecies. And he's basically saying, we got to figure out what our ancestors knew, and our ancestors who have departed need to turn their hearts to us from whatever realm they're in and help us in that effort. Otherwise, this cataclysm is going to happen, and it's going to be more than you can possibly imagine. But in terms of when we get into the numerology and things like that, you probably best to go with talk to her than to talk to me, because I'm not a numerologist. And by the way, my comment is that most people study the Bible ad infinitum. And why aren't they looking at the rest of the text that exists out there? For example, one of the classes in the Kimball College this month is called A Conversation Between Jesus and Peter, which was found in China. It's probably the most provocative, most profound teaching of Christ that I've ever read in my life. There are 70-some-odd sayings of Jesus in the Bible. My wife says 70 things an hour, for heaven's sake. Where's the rest of it? John said in John 21:25, he said, "And many things Jesus did, I suppose, if they were all written, the will itself could not contain all the books that should be written." Where's the rest of it? Well, people say it's been lost. No, it hasn't been lost. You just lost your library card.
Let's get a first-time caller line. Gary is in Fresno on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball of Kimball College. Gary?
Yes, good evening to both of you. In the King James Version of the Old Testament, they use the word, God used the word replenish, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth. And he said the same exact thing to Noah. Now, in the Aramaic, was the same word used for both translations, or were there different words used for them? And was that a correct translation?
Well, it would have been the Hebrew, if we were talking about the Old Testament. So, I mean, I could look up in the BDB when I get home. But Glenn, what do you know about that?
Well, you'd be better off to ask Michael Heiser that. But I think you're right on something there. Replenish means to restore. The time of Noah was a metaphor for what happened at the time of Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve came to replenish the earth for what it once had. And that means the population as well, not just the plants and the animals, it was people. We have the mummies of people much older than that, than the epoch of time of Adam and Eve. What are you going to say if you're a religious person to that? That's why many of our sons and daughters have no faith today, because they found the absolute positive proof that people have existed here for up to 100,000 years ago, and it's irrefutable proof. Well, the fact is that there have been people here, and they were in different epochs of time that were destroyed. Believe it or not, and let's take play those words. They were destroyed because they violated the laws of the earth and of God. And that's Plato. And he was probably an atheist. But
all right, let's, in fact, Gary, I tell you what, I'll do a little Hebrew word study on that, and I'll get it in the first hour next week. East of the Rockies, Calvin is in Texas on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball.
Good
Good morning, Glenn. I have two very brief questions, one that I gave your screener and one that I thought of while on hold. The first one was this amnesia you spoke of earlier. Does it seem that this amnesia was caused by a cataclysmic event that killed most of the people who knew any better or destroyed any of the texts that would carry on that we would know, you know, from before the cataclysmic event happened? And the second question is, where on the planet might the safest place be in 2012? Not necessarily entirely safe, but the safest place be on the planet.
Minnesota.
The amnesia I'm talking about is the amnesia created intentionally by science. They've wiped out more than they teach us. Pardon me, but that's just the truth of the matter, is that they refuse to countenance anything beyond what they teach at a university. And if you don't know that, you haven't got a PhD. You haven't gone and experienced this enormous onslaught of hey, if I don't teach it to you, it isn't true. You know, we've created our own amnesia. And then the other one was about where's
safest place to be.
Well, stay where you are. I when this cataclysm comes, I'm going on the roof with the tea, and I'm going to invite Ian, and we'll go watch it happen.
Well, you know what?
I live through this thing.
You know what I think would be, oddly enough, maybe the safest place to be? Arkansas.
It could be. I'll be honest with you. No one gets out of this world alive. That's an assurity. And the types of people that will survive this cataclysm, I'll tell you who they are. There are people with great libraries that will be artificially preserved to be able to teach the people into the future, and that's number one. And second of all, there'll be people with an understanding of the difference between good and evil. Pardon me, science doesn't want to talk about the difference between good and evil. For them, there is no difference between good and evil. It's a completely merged horizon. Well, there's a tremendous power behind goodness, which pervades it is in fact the prime directive of the universe, that those who have a drive and a feeling for goodness have power in them. Those who have evil intentions breed for themselves their own ending.
Well, in the line of demarcation that it exists between good guests and evil guests, Glenn, you'll always know you're top of the list on the good guests. And thank
you. You're very kind. But remember, you and I have a show to do in the future. And let me tell you what it is.
Okay.
We need to do the show on Aesop.
Okay, I'd love to. I'd be fascinated by that.
Wait. You think that Aesop's some boring little story about a
No, I'd love to. Let's do that. Let's do that. In fact, we'll book it. In the meantime, we'll have everybody scoot over to Kimball College through Coast to Coast AM. com, and I would love that, and I would love anything you've got on Prester John, too, my friend, as I continue my research there. Thank you, all of our guests, to Glenn, to Jack Cashel, to Cliff Kincaid, to Deus Te Amat, and I do, too.